So the title of this evening's talk is Silent, Still, Steady. Or Silence, Stillness and Spaciousness. Although it could also have been called, Silence, Stillness and Steadiness. It could also have been called Spaciousness, Solitude and Slowing Down. So, six S's. So we're all here in silence, allowing ourselves to slow a little from our busy, usual pace. And I'm sure Jill's already mentioned the relationship that that has with stilling the mind. And when there's outer stillness, then the inner stillness is enabled and facilitated. This afternoon I've been enjoying the stillness of this beautiful place. And as I look out across the landscape, I can feel this ancient silent stillness. It might sound like a strange thing to say when the wind is blowing ferociously, the trees are moving. But beneath that is a profound stillness. The stillness of mountains, of earth, of trees firmly rooted in the earth. There's a lot being written these days about silence and the value of silence, of quiet time. And the modern world is waking up to our need for this, in fact. I was recently watching a documentary based on a book called In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise by a man called George Proshnik. And this documentary really spelled out just how much we need this. Because we live in a world of fairly constant noise. While I was writing this Dharma talk at home, I could hear the buzz of a saw in the neighbourhood, traffic noise, the constant hum of a pump, a plane flying over. And I feel fortunate to live in a fairly quiet place. And we could say, maybe, that in a world of movement, stillness has become a great luxury. And in the world of distraction, presence has become a great luxury. And in a world of noise, perhaps we can feel the silence calling to us, calling us home, calling us to our true home. It's starting to be recognised what an impact this is having on us, all this noise. And the World Health Organization has said that noise pollution is a major environmental and public health burden, second only to air pollution. And it causes serious health effects. So particularly from persistent ongoing noise, like traffic noise, causes hypertension, high blood pressure, and even heart disease. The sound is a really powerful thing. It affects our brainwaves, our heartbeat, our breathing, our hormone secretions, all of our physical rhythms, all of the time. If we hear a sudden noise, there's a sudden burst of cortisol, the fight or flight hormone. If you put on pounding music when you're driving, you'll drive faster. If you imagine surf, it will calm you down and you might even go to sleep. So sound also affects our mood. If we think of music, music does this. A bird song. Maybe you've noticed that. Classical music has been found to reduce vandalism. So in Christchurch we have a place called the Hick Circle, and I think they started playing classical music there some years ago, to ensure that the people they didn't want hanging around there wouldn't be seen dead there. Mm-hmm. It worked. Too much noise also causes us to make poor decisions. And there was one study I read that had that said that over 440,000 people die each year in the US in hospitals there due to medical errors where noise levels are way over what's recommended. So they've drawn a link between those two things. And the need for silence and stillness is actually hardwired into us. For primitive man out there on the savannah, silence was essential to our survival. If we didn't pay attention to every little thing around us, we were going to be in trouble really fast. And we weren't going to find anything to eat. Evolutionary change only happens over a period of some 20,000 years. And the Industrial Revolution and all the noise and stimulation that's come into our modern life has happened in the last 200 years. So from a physiological standpoint, silence really is our natural milieu. And the further we get away from silence, perhaps the more we lose our connection with our deeper humanity. There's a new awareness of the importance of quiet in our lives. Who's heard of the UK brand of Quiet Mark? Heard of Quiet Mark? It's a, you know, a stamp that you get across 35 categories of product, like vacuum cleaners and what have you. Because consumers want to know that they're buying something that will give them peace and quiet. There's also, and I don't know if there's any in New Zealand, but there's bars overseas where there's no talking allowed. They have whispering-only zones. So it has to be under 39 decibels. I like the sound of that. There's been quite a few studies in Japan on the benefits of silence and quiet, and particularly in forest environments like we have here. And hanging out in a quiet forest has been found to strengthen our immune function, lower our stress, and increase our anti-cancer cell activity by 56%. So it's not just a nice and relaxing place to go out there, it's preventative medicine. A soundscape technician working in a national park in Alaska said that one of the things that he had noticed was that as the background level of noise decreases, our listening area increases. And in a really still environment, you have a situation where you feel very large acoustically. You can detect these really minute sounds from far, far away. And it gives you this incredible sense of space, of openness. So still, quiet places can really help us settle and connect into something deep, spacious and timeless. Have you felt that? Have you noticed how alive you feel at those moments? It's not just physical noise that's prevalent in our modern society, it's mental noise as well. I don't know about you, but my job has me pretty much thinking flat out all day, every day, with barely time for pause. It's really hard not to be busy, distracted, rushing, driven, on the go, all the time. How about you? how's your level of mental noise in your daily life? And something drives us to this, doesn't it? What is that? Because it's not all externally imposed. Some of it comes from ourselves. On the news the other night, I saw an article about nomophobia. Nomophobia. It stands for no mobile phone phobia. It's prevalent in 18 to 25 year olds. And if they don't have their mobile phone, it can result in panic attacks. That's how addicted we are to that stimulus. It's like there's something in us that wants that stimulation. Perhaps in order to feel alive. And it's like we're looking in the wrong direction. What would it be like to feel moved and impressed just by living? Just by being alive. By breathing, seeing, hearing, moving our body. Could there maybe be some joy to be found in that? In this movie, there was a man who took a vow of silence and was walking all the way across America from one coast to the other in 2019. And he said, "Time away has given me perspective on what I should allow back into my life and to what extent. Sometimes to really see things the way they truly are, you have to take a step back. And then another step, and then a few more." So here we are. That's what we're doing. We're on a silent retreat. Spending time with ourselves in solitude, in a kind of solitude. In this place of peace and beauty. Just being still. What a blessing. Maybe you've noticed a sense of relief. Pico Iyer, the author of the book The Art of Silence, says, "Retreating from the cacophony of the world is stepping towards everything that's essential. It's about stepping towards the world and really about learning to love the world again." So particularly in the context of a retreat, it's common to have some ideas about what silence is. We can find ourselves expecting or wanting a complete absence of sound, especially in the meditation hall. And if we don't get that, feeling like we can't meditate. And that's not what's meant by silence. And if we actually had that, it might be quite freaky. Don't you think? The composer John Cage, who was composing in the 50s, he went into an anechoic chamber. So that's one of those chambers they have in universities where they're absolutely soundproof. They've got these, you know, better than just egg cartons on the walls. They've got specially designed stuff on the walls that means that there's just no sound. And so he went into an anechoic chamber looking for the quietest place on earth. Because he'd been told, Find the silence and you'll find God. But he didn't find silence in the anechoic chamber. Instead, he could hear two sounds. And one was high pitched and the other was low. And he thought there was something wrong with the room, so he went to find the engineer in charge. And the engineer told him, yeah, that's right. The high one is your nervous system in operation, and the low one is your blood circulating. So even in an anechoic chamber, there's really no such thing as a complete absence of sound. Silence is not an absence of sound. And he didn't find God. So where to find God then? And he realised that silence, the silence that he was looking for, was something much deeper than that. Something that wasn't conditional on whether a sound was present or absent. Something that's always there, that sound arises out of and returns into, like bubbles on the surface of the water that burst. And he wrote a piece of music that's really not music at all. It's 4.5 minutes of silence. And when it was first performed in the 50s, the audience was absolutely incensed. Like, there was people that wanted to chase him out of town. And these days, we're a lot more enlightened. We kind of get that it's a meditation in which we're all silent together and nobody knows what's going to happen. And I'm told that a concert hall performance in a really big concert hall is an extraordinary thing. You feel the entire audience just listening to absolutely everything that happens. This breathing organism of people in this place sharing the moment together for 4.5 minutes. And so here we're performing a new composition. It's called 8,640 Minutes of Silence. That's 6 full days, I worked it out. Sharing this moment together, a breathing organism of people. Can we just listen to everything that happens? Can we sustain the magic of that? So silence is not about the absence of sound, but there's something about quiet places and nature that provide a real doorway into that deeper part of the heart. Something very precious that allows us the opportunity to expand, to become still, and to connect. And some of you may have found it can be quite daunting entering into silence. Might for some of you be starting to feel a bit more natural now by the third day. I can remember on my first retreat I wanted to scream for most of the 10 days. But anyway, here we are, willingly embracing silence and stillness, not chattering, not filling our minds with noise, not filling our minds with all the thought bubbles that come out of the mouths of others, not moving much, just slowing down, settling, stilling, turning inwards, turning towards ourselves, meeting ourselves fully. And it can be a risky enterprise. Have you found that? There was a woman in this documentary and she said, if you allow silence to circulate, particularly among people, what you're going to discover is that your mind becomes aware of what the truth is, And sometimes the truth is not that sugar-coated. Sometimes you might have to face that things are not going the way you might want, and that you're losing or failing. You might feel out of control, because silence makes you aware that you're not that in control of anything, really. So it puts people against a wall and it says, this is you, and you're human, and you're existing right now, and this is your reality. Do you like it? And often people say, no! Silence is a journey into the wilderness and into the dark. Silence is a journey right into the heart of your being. And so it's important at times like these to meet ourselves gently, very gently, to hold ourselves with kindness and compassion, as Jill was led us in the beautiful meditation earlier this afternoon. I have a new favourite book. It's called The First Free Woman. And it's poems of the very early Buddhist nuns. And they're magic. So I thought I would weave some of them throughout this talk. And these are nuns, these are women who've come from all walks of life, from all backgrounds. Some are mothers, some were street workers, everything. The Buddha's own aunt is in here as well. So this poem is about meeting ourselves gently, and it's called The Elephant. It's by Dantika. While walking along the river after a long day meditating, I watched an elephant splashing its way out of the water and up the bank. Hello, my friend, a man waiting there said, scratching the elephant behind its ear. Did you have a good bath? The elephant stretched out its leg, the man climbed up, and the two rode off like that, together. Seeing what had once been so wild, now a friend and companion to this good man, I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. Truly, I thought, this is why I came to the woods. To reach out a gentle hand to the wildness of our own mind. So taking up silence and solitude is what our practice calls us to do. And these have been a key practice in every spiritual tradition. Jesus, the Buddha, Muhammad, the Hindu sages, they all went off into the wilderness to reflect, to contemplate, before returning to share their understandings with the world. And there are certain paths in this life that we need to walk alone. And the Buddha frequently mentioned the benefits of solitude. There's a very famous quote where he said, there are trees and the roots of trees. Meditate now, lest you regret it later. And in case that seems a bit obscure, they were part of a tradition that the Buddhist tradition was to meditate in forests. So forests were a quiet place to meditate in solitude. And they didn't have cushions like we have today. So the roots of trees and sitting underneath a tree was the best place to meditate. So there are trees and the roots of trees. Meditate now, lest you regret it later. There's a poem in here about that too. This is by Kima, whose name I think means house of peace. He said, when a bow rubs against the strings of a well-tuned violin, music flows through all the heavens and brings life to all the worlds. Come, Kima, be my little viola. Make me your bow. When a symphony is over, I told him, there's nothing left but the applause and some sweeping up. After the tune you mean to play, I would carry the encore for 9 long months, and it wouldn't end there. This is the song your parents played as they watched the stars circling high above. This is the song their parents played as they tended their fires deep in the dark forest. It is an old, old song. But listen closely. Far from human voices, there are songs of freedom, sung only by the wind in the leaves. And I think that when the Buddha gave that instruction, there are trees and the roots of trees, meditate now lest you regret it later, it was meaning more than that it's beneficial to go off and do our own practice, or that each of us needs to work on our practice ourselves. No one else can do it for us. Or even that we don't know how long we have, so we'd better get on with it. It seems to me that in that instruction, he was also pointing to the possibility of finding, of entering, a deep silence, a still point within us. The silence that's not the absence of sound, and a stillness that's not the absence of movement. Roshi Gensho Hozumi from a temple in Japan says, through practice, you need to feel the silence with your own body. Experience it every day, and then it becomes part of you. And perhaps most of us know what he's talking about and have felt this deep inner silence at some point in our lives. And perhaps for some, that's what brought you to practice. I can remember as a young woman in my teens being alone in nature, in a forest, in absolute teeming rain, and just feeling very, very still, mind very quiet, the heart very still, calm, grounded presence, and a wonderful sense of aloneness, but in connection with everything. Part of the ancient earth. Do any of you know what I mean? A few nods. What did that feel like? Could you put one word to it? I'm inviting you to speak. You felt that real stillness in nature.
Harmony.
Expansive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bold.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing those words. And I'm sure that many of the shyer ones of you also know what that experience feels like. And the Buddha also had this experience as a 9-year-old. He was sitting under a rose apple tree at the side of the paddock that his father was tilling. And he was just feeling very calm. It was very pleasant. Mind was quite still. Very at ease. And reflecting on it later, you know, he wondered if that was the way, because he'd gone off and he'd studied with all the great teachers of his time, and he'd reached their level of attainment, and then not still being free, he'd gone off to become an ascetic, you know, to deprive his body of food and take up really rigorous practices. And still not finding that true freedom, that lasting happiness that's not dependent on conditions. And so he thought back to this time when he was sitting under this tree, and he wondered if that could be the way. To deepen into that. And that's what he did. Under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. And that led to his awakening. So the story goes. And in fact, stillness and calm, abiding tranquility, peacefulness, is one of the 7 factors of awakening. So tranquility, or pasādi, is one of the 7 factors of awakening, which in the language spoken at the time of the Buddha was called bhojanga. One of the 7 bhojanga. And I was looking into the 7 factors of awakening online when I was writing this talk, and I came across this real gem because it captured how I felt at times when listening to Dharma talks myself, you know, where you're hearing the 4 this and the 5 that and the eightfold path and the... Some of you are laughing, so you know what I mean. And in this particular little dialogue, this monk is obviously feeling quite distressed at not getting it. And he says, "Venerable Sir," he says to the Buddha, "Venerable Sir, I keep hearing bhojanga, bhojanga. In what sense are they factors of enlightenment?" And the Buddha replies, "They lead to enlightenment, monk. Therefore, they are called factors of enlightenment." And he must have been quite an annoying fellow at times, don't you think? And then he said, the Buddha said, "Just as in a peaked house, all rafters whatsoever go together to the peak, slope to the peak, join in the peak, and of them all, the peak is reckoned chief, even so, monks, the monk who cultivates and makes much of the 7 factors of wisdom slopes to nirvana, inclines to nirvana, tends to nirvana." Waking up. So that's great. And all 7 of them are qualities that we regularly use in our everyday activities. So they're not something strange or unusual to us. Do you want to know what they are? Okay. So the first one is mindfulness. What we've been practicing here. Present moment awareness. And once mindfulness is established, then that leads to the 2nd factor. We can engage in investigation. Investigation so that we can clearly see and clearly distinguish the details of each moment. So investigation has qualities of curiosity and interest. And then the 3rd factor is energy. Energy means applying our attention, being attentive to what is happening. It's like when we adjust the steering wheel in the car, we're being attentive. I need to make this little adjustment here. An interested effort, energy, brings a sense of the 4th factor, which is joy. Joy or happiness or contentment, which is also one of the four Brahma Viharas, or divine abodes, which Jill is going to speak about. But joy or happiness or contentment is essential for maintaining a steady practice. If there isn't some joy in our practice, it's going to be really hard to sustain. And the well-being of joy relaxes mental and emotional agitation, which brings the fifth factor, which is tranquility, calm, relaxation. And that then in turn supports concentration, which is the ability to focus on the task at hand and not be pulled away by distractions or by fatigue. It's a unified state of mind. Mind and body have gathered together and are one-pointed. And all six of these are conditions for equanimity, which is the seventh factor. Equanimity is the steadiness of mind in the face of the way things are, whatever arises. And the more these qualities are present, the easier it is to be fully engaged with our practice. They help make our practice more satisfying, more beneficial. And so we cultivate and strengthen them. And they're actually known as inner wealth. And tranquility, or prasadi, is compared to the happy experience of a weary walker who sits down under a tree in the shade, or the cooling of a hot place by rain. And it said, hard it is to tranquilize the mind. It trembles and is unsteady, difficult to guard and hold back. It quivers like a fish taken from its watery home and thrown on the dry ground. So if that's how your mind is feeling, and it might be, certainly how my mind has felt at times, then you're in good company. That's what minds do. And while they wander at will, and no one is saying that tranquility or calm or stillness is easy to develop. Because one of the things that can happen when you hear a talk like this and you hear these words about silence and stillness and calm is that it can just serve to reinforce that you're not feeling any of those. Is that true for some of you? A little bit? And I want to say that not feeling still and silent is just fine. These things come in their own time and they can't be hurried. We can be with just where we are. And this is a poem for you, if that's your experience. This is by a woman called Sama, which means song. After 25 years on the path, I'd experienced almost everything except peace. When I was young, my mother told me that I would find true happiness only in marriage. Remembering her words all those years later, something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling, and it showed me all the pain this little heart had ever known, and how countless lives of searching had brought me at last to the present moment, which I happily married. Can you imagine? We've been living together ever since, without a single argument. So we practice, we look closely, we investigate. And we look at what we're feeding our minds and what is the result. What are we inputting and what is the result? I have to read you another one. It's a bit out there, this one. Anyway, this is by Sundari Nanda, whose name means joy of beauty. One morning, after another long night, I was squatting on the toilet, watching it all come out. For the first time, I saw my body, not just how it looks, but what it does, turning what is dear into what is waste. I got up and started walking. As the sun was setting, I passed a graveyard. You, my sisters beneath the leaves, as I am, so you once were. As you are, so will I become. There I slept, and there I stayed, examining this mass of flesh and bones, contemplating the many masses of flesh and bones gently rotting just beneath the ground. Then one morning I saw what goes in must come out. Not just the body, but the mind. What will you bring into the world other than what gets washed down the toilet? I bet you've never been asked quite like that before. What will you bring into the world other than what gets washed down the toilet? Will you bring in something that doesn't last? Or will you bring a lasting happiness into the world? One that doesn't depend on circumstance? Will you bring freedom into the world? While there can be chaos in the world and in our inner life, there's also the possibility of peace. It's possible through silence, stillness, and practice to cultivate and experience peace. Zen Jew Earthlyn Manuel, author of The Deepest Peace, says, "There is a peace that appears without effort, like the desert filling up before your eyes. It appears like snow, wind, or rain. The simple willingness to be close to the earth will open ground for the deepest peace. It arrives on its own if we let it." Last one of this. So this is by Patachara. His name means wandering robe. She was one of the most famous of the early nuns. Farmers turn up the soil, plant seeds, and wait. All by itself, water pours down from the sky and turns earth into food. After all these years sleeping on the ground, waking before dawn and begging for every meal, where's my harvest? Late one evening, I was washing my feet after another long day of sitting and walking. The water poured over my feet and onto the ground. I let my mind go, and it flowed downhill with the water, towards my little hut. I went inside, sat on the bed, and lowered the wick of the lamp. All by itself, the flame went out. When this tranquility is present, We can simply see the rise and fall of all the things, all of our experience, how things come into being and pass away. We can see all that without being troubled by it or being caught up in it, caught in reaction to it. So a stillness and a calm and deep silence leads directly to steadiness and a strength. Somebody said bold before, a strength in the face of experience. And in fact, the roots of the word silence are related to the wind dying down or the stopping of motion. And they're also related to an interruption, not just of sound, but also it's to do with the interruption of the imposition of our own egos on the world. An interruption. Something has to stop. And this is the third noble truth that Jill talked about on the first evening. The noble truth of cessation. The stopping of our ego reactivity in the face of moment-to-moment experience. All of the clinging and grasping and seeking, our wish to change it from what we don't like into what we like, to resist it, to grasp onto it, to constantly wriggle in response to our life. Ajahn Sucitto, who is the abbot of one of the monasteries in the UK, says this: there's no need to add anything to our experience. Instead of thinking about it, worrying about it, blaming it, making brave resolutions that we can't keep, or interpreting it and analysing it and thinking we understand it, we reel it in to the point where presence resonates with it. We reel it in. In other words, we become intimate with our experience, all experience, rejecting nothing until presence is resonating with everything. And he says, this is the realization that leads to cessation. The movement has stopped, and now it's at rest. Every insight arises from cessation. Something finally stops running. And there has to be a moment of stopping in order for wisdom to emerge, for insight to occur. If even for a moment we fully surrender to life, if the mind stops its movement, chasing after the pleasant and running away from the unpleasant, when we finally stop, not only does our suffering stop, but our ignorance stops as well. We see clearly. Lao Tzu, the great Taoist sage, said, to the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. To the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. A few years ago, a good friend of mine went on a tramping trip up into the mountains. And she was really deep in the mountains, in a very wild and free place. And my friend spent the day in meditative activities, writing and sketching. And there was a woman in the hut there who was very sensitive to energy, to the subtle energy body. And this woman said to my friend, your energy is exactly the same as this place. And this was very unusual, and she was really puzzled, and she just could not work it out. And it just happens that my friend is a Zen master, a Zen Roshi. And my friend didn't let on about that. But what does that mean? Your energy is exactly the same as this place. all of the energy of being someone, having, doing, getting, becoming, improving, grasping, seeking, avoiding, resisting, manipulating my circumstances so that I get things the way I like them, trying to be still, trying to stay with every breath. When all of that falls away, we come into attunement with this vast ancient ground of being. We're really in resonance with all of life. And there's something profound to be understood from that. It's as simple as shifting our attention to the vast interior spaciousness, to our natural silence. It's a process of ungrasping, the process of opening your hand, opening your heart, the process of unclenching the fist. Letting ourselves be. Let our experience be just the way it is. And just settling into however things are right now. Recognizing the value of not constantly inputting things into the mind and our senses. Recognizing the value of having put ourselves in this place. If we could all learn the work of silence, of deep stillness, we'd take an awful lot of pressure off our planet. There wouldn't be this constant seeking for something else to fill up the empty space. We need to learn to be able to be silent and build a wellspring of silence that we can draw upon at times when our environment isn't conducive. We need to cultivate the ability to live from that well of silence. At the deep core of who you are, there is a silent, beautiful spaciousness and stillness that is before thought, before the mind moves, deeper than the conversational mind, than the various ideas and concepts. A wordless dimension of the heart. And this is a beautiful resource for us to deepen into. When we slip into that great well of silence, we find a deep communion with all beings, with all of life. We are unbounded, vast, including not less than everything. We are free. So let's treasure this silence, guard this silence, abide in this silence together. And let's just sit for a couple of minutes together.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.